We looked last time, 1 Samuel chapter 19, we saw three different occasions in which David fled from Saul. We see the first one was Jonathan's intervention with Saul in behalf of David. And Saul basically realized, at least for a short time, that what he had been doing was wrong. And so he welcomed David back into his court. But soon after that, we saw that the success David had in fighting against the Philistines brought out the jealousy and the anger and the hatred in Saul again. And once again, the evil spirit from God came upon him. And when David played for him, he once again tried to pin David to the wall with a spear. So he had to flee. He goes back home, and his wife, Michal, comes up invents a scheme to basically cover for him, let him get away, and then cover for him and give him some time to get away. And so we see that being used to help David flee from Saul. And he flees to go to be with Samuel, and Samuel's there with the prophets. And how many times does Saul send his servants after him? Remember? Three different times he sends servants to take David and to bring him back and to kill him. And each time, what happened to the servants? The Holy Spirit of God fell upon them and they prophesied. And after those three failures of Saul's attempts to get David, he goes himself. And what happens to him? Same thing happens to him. The Holy Spirit of God falls upon him and he prophesies. And he actually speaks the word of God that God gives him. We talked about the close of last lesson that I think that was an opportunity for both Saul and David to learn something. When God intervened in that way, in that special way, and protected David and thwarted Saul's attempts to kill David, I think that it's just God's way of saying to Saul, listen, and he said, you can still be used of me. You can still, have the Spirit of God in your life. You can still have, God's working in your life. Not as king, but you can certainly turn to the Lord, and that would happen. But does he respond to that? We're going to see tonight that no, he doesn't respond to that at all. And what does David have an opportunity to see?
God can protect him.
Yeah, but God's going to take care of you. I mean, did David do anything? David didn't do anything. He didn't try to escape from them. He didn't, surround himself with soldiers or anything. God simply took care of it. God stopped every effort by Saul to kill him. And I think that was a message to David. God will take care of you. I will take care of you. Did he take care of him against the lion? Did he take care of him against the lion and the bear as he was a shepherd with his father's sheep? Every time, God's been there for him. But as we're going to find out tonight, David didn't learn the lesson either. Now, we don't want to be just too hard on David, because think about what David's going through right now. I mean, I haven't sat down and counted it up, but think about how many attempts there have been on his life. Just recently, with all of these attempts. And think about who he's up against. Who's the one who's going after him? The king. He have any power? He have any soldiers, any servants he could send to do the work? He's got a lot of things to go. So, and how did David feel about Saul? We really haven't talked about that, but how do you think David feels about Saul?
He feels that Saul is God's anointed one.
He knows that God, and Saul is God's anointed. God placed him in that position. He knows that. What else? Who's Saul's son? Jonathan. And how does David feel about Jonathan? Oh, they are bonded together with a deep friendship and love for each other. So how would you feel about the father of your best friend? I mean, that type of situation as well. So he's going through a lot, and the pressure is on him to a great degree. But he doesn't handle it well. He doesn't handle it well. Let's look at chapter 20. Start with me in verse 1. We're going to look at, if you get through them all, three schemes, and that's my word, not in the scriptures, three schemes of David to try to evade Saul. Evade Saul and protect himself from Saul. Look at verse 1. And David fled from Naoth and Ramah. And he went and he said to Jonathan, what have I done? Now this is after Saul has sent three sets of servants after him. Saul has come and pursued him. So Saul's trying to kill him. He's seen three attempts there in that chapter to kill him. So he goes to Jonathan and he asks him, what have I done? He says, what is my iniquity? What's my sin? What's my sin before your father that he seeks my life? Why is he doing this? And you can hear the frustration in those questions. Goes on, verse 2. Jonathan said to him, by no means, you shall not die. You shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great or small, without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. Now, you look at that. Jonathan wants to feel good about his father, doesn't he? He wants to believe that his father's changed. And what has he got that maybe gives him that idea that his father might have changed? What's the last thing that happened with Saul?
He prophesied.
Yeah, the last thing is, he did do that. Now, in the last chapter, he did make a promise to Jonathan that he would not harm David. You know, he swore that he would not harm David. The last thing that happens, though, is that he's actually filled with the Holy Spirit and he prophesies. And so I think Jonathan takes that as a positive sign. You know, my father's not going to do this. You know, he doesn't want to believe that his father's capable of doing the things that he's done already or the things that he's going to do. And so he says, it's just not so. And he says, why should my father? And if he were going to do anything, he would tell me about it. So David took an oath again and he said, your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. David says, you don't understand what's going on with your father. He says, your father knows about our close relationship. Your father knows that. That's why he's not going to tell you everything, because he doesn't want to grieve your heart at your, you know, at your father's animosity toward me and his hatred of me and his attempts to kill me. So David is more realistic about this. He understands a little bit more about what's going on with Saul and Jonathan. Or you might say maybe he's not as optimistic. Yeah, I don't know how you all look at it. He's not as optimistic about Saul as Jonathan is. He says, but truly, for verse 3, truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there's but a step between me and death. And that's what he feels right now. Now, those are genuine feelings, no question about that. But where do those feelings come from? Is that from the Spirit of God who makes him feel that way? Or is that from the flesh that makes him feel that way? You see, you can see him moving back toward walking in the flesh rather than walking in the Spirit. Doesn't mean the Spirit of God has departed from him. It's just like us. I mean, the Spirit of God does not depart from us, does it? But do we always walk according to the Spirit? Do we always let the Spirit of God fill us and control us and direct us in our lives? No, we don't. And I think that's what's going on with David right now. He's not letting the Holy Spirit of God that indwells him direct him. And so he says, there's just a step between me and death. Now, actually, that may be true. But who's standing between him and death? God is. Even if it's just a step, God's still standing between him and death. So we go in Jonathan, verse 4. When Jonathan hears how David feels, he said to David, whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you. I may not agree with you on what you're feeling about my father, but whatever you desire, I'll do it for you. Because that's how much he loves David. And David said to Jonathan, indeed, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king to eat. I mean, David's still technically a part of Saul's court, is he not? He's expected to be there. He's one of Saul's servants. So when they get together and celebrate one of the feasts of the Lord or a new moon or a Sabbath, then he's going to be expected to be there, and he recognizes that. And he says this in verse 5, he says, let me go, that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. And then if your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, where there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. And if he says thus, well, it's well, then your servant will be safe. I'll be safe, he says that. But if he's very angry, be sure that evil is determined. If he gets angry about this, be sure that evil is determined by him. Now, just think about this for just a second. What's David telling Jonathan to do? So you go in, and you sit down at the meal, and if Saul, I'm not going to go. I'm going to stay away for 3 days. And if Saul asks about me, what do you say?
You're telling a lie.
Yeah. You tell him I've gone home to Bethlehem to celebrate a special Sabbath and to be with my family during that time. Okay? He said, you tell him that. And then we'll see how he reacts. If he says, that's great, then he'll know everything's okay. He doesn't want to harm me. But if he gets angry about it, then obviously evil is determined by him. Therefore, you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. They made a covenant all the way back, we saw in chapter 18, I believe it was. He says, nevertheless, if there's iniquity in me, kill me yourself. If I've done something wrong, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? Jonathan said, far be it from you, for if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you? I'll tell you that. And David said to Jonathan, who will tell me, or what if your father answers you roughly? What if your father is angry with you? Well, what's going to happen then? Jonathan said to David, come, let's go out into the field. So both of them went out into the field. Now, we're going to read through all of this chapter. I would encourage you to do so. But if you go and read this, the next portion of this, beginning there in verse 14 down through verse 17, Jonathan renews his covenant with David. He wants the covenant restated. He wants it restated so number one, he can tell David again, he can vow to David how devoted he is to him, how much he loves him, and do so in the sight of God. But he wants to hear those words from David too. He wants to hear those words. So they, in a sense, renew their vows, I guess you might say, or they renew this covenant of love that they have for each other. And then Jonathan comes up with a way of saying, listen, and I will give you a signal. I'll give you a signal to let you know how my father reacts. Because David's going to be where? He's going to be out in the field. And that's what he does. That's where he goes. Look at verse 18. He says, Jonathan said to David, tomorrow's the new moon, and you'll be missed because your seat will be empty. Saul will see that. I was kind of amazed by this. What's Saul been trying to do? Kill him. You would kind of wonder why Saul would think David might show up at all. I would wonder that. Why would Saul think David would show up at all? He says, your seat will be empty. He'll notice that. Verse 19. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed and remain by the stone easel. Now, the day of the deed is back when Jonathan and his father were out in the field, back to the first part of chapter 19. And Saul agreed that he would not try to kill David. He made a vow that he would not try to kill David. So that's when Jonathan intervened. So you go back to that same place and remain by the stone of Ezel. And I says, then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. I'll go out like I'm pretending I'm going out and just doing target shooting. Because what is Jonathan? What does he do very often? He's a warrior, is he not? He's part of the army. He's a commander in the army. So for him to go out and do target practice is not an unusual thing. He says, that's what I'll do. I'll go out and shoot arrows. And I'll shoot 3 arrows as though I shot at a target. And there I'll send the lad saying, go find the arrows. Now, if I expressly say to the lad, look, the arrows are on this side of you. Get them and come. Then as the Lord lives, and this is his vow, he's this oath, as the Lord lives, there is safety for you. And there's no harm. That's the signal. If I say that, if I shoot the arrows on one side, then everything is safe. You can come back. But if I say thus to the young man, look, the arrows are beyond you. Go your way, for the Lord has sent you away. If I say they're beyond you, then you'll know you need to get away. You need to go get away quickly. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed, the Lord be between you and me. How long? Forever. In fact, he makes one particular request. Look at verse 14. The one request I want to look at, he says, you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die. He says, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house. How long? Forever. He's asking for his descendants, his children, grandchildren. He says, no, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Because God, Jonathan recognizes one of these days, David's going to be king. He knows that. He believes that because God has promised that. And David's one who believes the word of God. So he says, when that happens, he asked him to please show kindness to, you know, even after I die, show kindness to those who come after me and my family and my house. All right, let's go to the day of the new moon, verse 24. Then David hid in the field. Okay, there's some question about, did David go home or not? Did David tell a lie when he said he was going home to Bethlehem to celebrate the Sabbath? But there's several places in here where it makes it sound like to me that David hid in the field. And this is what it says right here. I don't think he went home. When the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. Now the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side. But David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, in his heart, he says, something has happened to him. He must be unclean. Surely he is unclean. If you're unclean, you can't come and celebrate this feast of the Lord. So he says, that must be what's going on here. So what happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place again was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why is the son of Jesse not come to eat, either yesterday or today? What does he call him? Son of Jesse. Interesting. I'm not calling him David. Remember what David means? Maybe he can't come to call himself a word that means beloved. But that's what it means. So he calls him son of Jesse. I think he calls him that term because it's a way of degrading David. I think he's a way of trying to degrade David. And he's angry because he's asking why. He asked Jonathan this. Why do you think he asked Jonathan?
Because he knows their relationship.
Because he knows about their relationship. He knows how close they are. So he goes and turns to him. Jonathan answered Saul, said, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And that is a lie. That's not really what happened. That was the scheme. This was David's scheme. Okay, and Jonathan goes along with it. And so he said, please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he has not come to the king's table. And again, reading through the passage to me, I don't believe that he ever went to Bethlehem. I don't believe any of those things actually happened. I think this was all part of David's scheme and deception to just to find out what Saul was feeling about him. You know, is he still angry? Is he still out to kill me? And so he tells him that. And look at verse 30. Saul must recognize that this is not true. And he says, Saul's anger was aroused against who? Jonathan. Again, because he knows about their relationship. He knows how close they are. And so he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. I read one commentary. It says it's basically it's a strong negative statement, strong curse, almost saying you're a son of Belial. You know, if you look in there, the word woman is in italics. It's not in the original because he uses the expression son of. Many think it is a reference to his mother, and so it could be. And some have speculated that that Jonathan's mother, Saul's, one of Saul's wives, was, you know, sided with Jonathan with David against Saul, and so he's angry at her. It's possible. It could be that it just means you son of perversity and rebellion. It means he's a person who's characterized by perversity and rebellion, at least in Saul's minds. So he's angry at him, and he curses at him like this. He says, "Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse?" Same title again, son of Jesse, to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness. Now, what did he mean by that? That's an interesting statement. You have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness. It's a pretty strong statement, too. What does it mean? Well, Jonathan chose to be friends with David, close friends, and to support David, and to support the idea that David's one day going to be what?
King.
Which means, who won't be king? Well, Saul won't, but also Jonathan won't. When Saul's days are over as king, the kingdom's not going to be passed down to Jonathan. He says, that's to your own shame. But you're not going to step in and be the king of Israel. And it's also to the shame of your mother. Because the king's mother is in a high ranked position in the kingdom. A very, very high position as far as respect and authority. And so he says, you brought shame not only upon yourself, but upon your mother. And you've left her without being able to wear the royal robes and so forth. And so he says, you've done this to yourself and to your family. It's verse 31. For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. I think at this point in time, maybe Jonathan realizes that David was right. David was right about Saul all along. He didn't want to believe it, but you can see it here. And brought on just by the fact that David wasn't there, and Jonathan gives an explanation. I don't know if Saul knows the explanation was false. I don't know why he got so angry. Or if he just senses that Jonathan's protecting him. Maybe Jonathan's not a good liar. I don't know what it was, but he sensed something was wrong about this, and he became so angry. And Jonathan, verse 32, answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? He'd already made this argument once before. What has he done? You know, this is injustice. This is not a righteous thing that you're doing. Look at verse 33. And then Saul cast a spear at him. To do what? Kill him. This is his own son. He is so angry. He is so jealous. He is so envious of David. Because Jonathan has this bond of love and this covenant with him, this closeness to him, he just puts the two of them together and he wants to kill him too. And so he casts a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. That's what he was going to do. So Jonathan arose from the table. He's mad. He's angry. In fierce anger. He ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. His father had treated both of them shamefully, hadn't he? David, he kept calling him what? Son of Jesse. But he had also treated Jonathan shamefully as well. And so he was angry. So he goes out on the field and they go through with the signal. He goes out to shoot arrows and he shoots the arrows and he gives the instruction and he calls out and look at verse 36. He said to his lad, "Now run and find the arrows which I shoot." And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the lad had come to the place where the arrow was, which Jonathan had said, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And Jonathan cried out after the lad, "Make haste, hurry, do not delay." Now, who are those words for? Those are for David. Those are all for David. Now, this was this signal was a good thing and positive thing in regard to protection. Who's protected by the fact that they're using this signal?
Jonathan's
protected. The whole thing is to protect David. One more.
The servant.
The servant. That young boy. You know, is Saul crazy enough to kill anybody? He's already tried to kill David several times. He's just thrown a spear at his son Jonathan. He would think nothing about killing this young boy. And so this protects all of them. Because the boy doesn't know what's going on. So Jonathan sends the lad back in with his archery equipment and so forth. And look at verse 41. As soon as the lad had gone, David arose from a place toward the south. And he fell on his face to the ground and he bowed down three times. He is just so grateful to Jonathan for Jonathan's love for him, for his protection for him, for his being willing to be a part of this and help him. And so they kissed one another and they wept together. But David more so. David was so grieved by the fact that he and Jonathan were going to be separated in this way. Because that's what this means. David's going to have to leave. In fact, from this point on, David will be a fugitive in his life from now on. And that not only separates him from Saul to save his life, but that also separates him from the person that he's closest to, and that's Jonathan. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord be between you and me. May He be that bond that brings us together.'" Isn't that the greatest thing to describe? What's the basis for a friendship? Well, that's the best basis right there, that the Lord would be between you as friends. And He was between these two. He says, "And not only between you and me, but between your descendants and my descendants forever." And so David arose and departed, and Jonathan went back into the city. So the first scheme that we see this. Now, let me ask this question. Was God involved in David's scheme?
Only in a sense.
What sense?
He's going to work it out for good,
but
no, he wasn't sponsoring it. No, he was doing it.
Yeah, we have to understand and look at the providence of God. When you look at God's providence, that's where God sees things beforehand, knows what's going to happen, and uses His knowledge of those things to work out His determined plan of purpose. Is God going to place David on the throne?
Yes.
Nothing's going to stop that. You know, nothing's going to change that. But that doesn't mean that everything that happens to bring that about is necessarily the will of God. Not everything that happens to bring that about would have been God's choice for this. Could God have done it another way? If David hadn't come up with this scheme at all, would God have protected him? Some way or another. We don't know how, because we don't get the opportunity to see it. David didn't give us that opportunity to see what have happened. But God would have taken care of him, because He already demonstrated that as well. I don't think He directed David. And David didn't ask. David didn't ask God, "What do you want me to do about this? How do I handle this?" You don't see that in that instance or in the next two instances we're going to look at. Look with me at chapter 21. David flees. Chapter 21, verse 1. David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest. This is where the tabernacle was at that time. Tabernacle is not, in Jerusalem yet. Jerusalem is not even a part of the nation of Israel yet. So he says he came to there where the priest was, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David. And he said to him, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" And he had a few people there, but, he was not what he expected when he saw David come to visit him there at the tabernacle. So David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you, and I have directed my young men to such and such a place.'" What is that? That's another lie, is it not? And the more you do it, the more complicated it gets. The more you get into lying, and the more you get into telling, trying to deceive people, the more complex it gets. Because, think about how this sounds. The king has sent me on some business, and told me, don't let anybody know what this business is. Don't let anybody know what I've sent you to do or what I've commanded you. That almost sounds kind of, you know, flaky, doesn't it? That just doesn't sound, doesn't ring true at all. But it has to be that way when you're caught up in deception. And David says, now therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, well, there's no common bread on hand. The only bread that they're going to have there in the tabernacle is going to be what? Yeah, the showbread. Yeah, the table of showbread. So he says, there's not any common bread. I don't have anything I can give you there. He says, there's holy bread, if the young men have at least kept themselves from women. Now, this has taken David about 3 days to get here. So David can answer this way, truly. He said, answered the priest and said, truly women have been kept from us for about 3 days since I came out. And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day. What happened is they had just changed the bread out. Because that's what happens. You know, you don't use the same bread continually. You put out table, you know, the loaves, and then eventually they replace those with fresher loaves. And what happens to the other loaves? Well, the priests eat those. They eat those. So the priest, it says, verse 6, gave him holy bread. For there was no bread there but the show bread which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. So they took the older show bread and David ate it. Now you say, was that wrong? Normally you would say what? Who's that bread reserved for? The priest, and that's what the law specifies. But can God overrule even His own laws? Yeah, He can. He can give special dispensations. And Jesus talked about this very thing. Remember when His disciples were going through the fields and they were plucking heads of grain and so forth, and hadn't washed their hands and so forth, and Jesus made reference back to this. And said, because God, take the idea, God desires mercy more than He does sacrifice. It's not just keeping the nitpicky details of the law. It's being merciful and compassionate to men and women. That's why the law was given, was to meet the needs of God's people. To meet the needs of God's people. David's need here is for food. He's going to be on the run. He needs food. And so they give it to him. The priest gives him the holy bread. Verse 7, now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day. He says that he had been detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, the Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. So there's a man who was left behind here. He's a herdsman, he's a servant of Saul, and he's there to see all this. He's there to see all this happen. And David said to Ahimelech, is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. Went off and left my sword and my spear at home. I had to get away so quickly. Another little bit of truth to that one. He did have to get away quickly. He did have to get away quickly. And if you want to redefine business as being I was fleeing from the king, that might be a true statement. That's closer than the other one. So the priest told him, this is the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah. There it is. It's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you'll take that, take it, for there is no other except that one here. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. And I always think this is kind of ironic. How powerful was that sword when it was held in the hands of Goliath? There's none like this sword, David said. That just seems kind of strange for him to say that. He did use the sword. He did use it to cut Goliath's head off. There's no question about that. And certainly the sword, I think, probably at least has some special meaning to David. It reminds him of better days, does it not? It reminds him of a time that he put his true faith in the Lord. But here, what does he think he needs? I need a weapon. Did he need that when he went up against Goliath?
He needs something to protect himself.
He needs something to protect himself. He needed a weapon. He needed something. He didn't feel that when he stood before Goliath, did he? He says, you come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in what? In the name of the Lord. And He will give me the victory. And, now you don't see that same element of faith and trust in God. You don't see that dependence upon God that we saw before. You see David, I need food, I need a weapon, I need to protect myself, I need to get away from Saul. And again, has he asked God's direction in any of this? Not that we can see. Now look what happens. It goes downhill from... And this one is going to come back with some terrible consequences. This second scheme, where he comes in and lies to the priest, is going to result in some terrible consequences in David's life and the life of these people. Look at verse 10. Then David arose and he fled again that day from before Saul. And he went to Achish, the king of Gath. Where was Goliath from? He was from Gath. He went to the Philistines. He goes down to one of the five basically countries of the Philistines down there. One of them is Gath. And that's where Goliath is from. He goes to the place where their champion was from. He goes to their king, King Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish, they recognized him. I would imagine they might do it, you know. They recognized David. David's kind of famous in the Philistia, isn't he? You know, he beat Goliath. Everybody's heard about David. And so the servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land?" Interesting statement. They didn't look at Saul as the king. Who did they look at as the king? The one who came out and fought against their champion, the one who won the battle against their champion. Here's the true king of the land. He says, "Isn't this David the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? They even knew what people sang about him. So they recognized him. What's David going to do now? He's there in the camp of the Philistines. He's there. He's got a sword, I guess, at least, to protect himself with. But, you know, is he the same man that fought against Goliath? Not right now. He didn't have the same heart that he had when he fought against Goliath. And he doesn't react in the same way. Look at the next verse, verse 12. David took these words to heart. He listened and understood, I'm in trouble here. I'm in danger here. And he was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. Now, do you think Achish was 9 feet tall? Do you think he was a big, powerful, you know, warrior that was going to... He's afraid of this king, but he wasn't afraid of Goliath. You see the change? In fact, not just afraid, he was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. What's he going to do? He's got another scheme. And that's exactly what it is. Yes?
Do we know what time period has lapsed between David killing Goliath at this point?
Several years. Yeah, but I don't know exactly how much. But it's been several years, I think. So, but look at what he does in verse 13. He changed his behavior before them. Change of behavior. What did he do? He pretended madness in their hands. He scratched on the doors of the gate. He let his saliva fall down on his beard. And I understand that's a very shameful thing for a man to do. For his saliva to come down into his beard. It's just a very, very shameful thing. He's willing to do that. Scratched on the doors like he's crazy. Like he's crazy. Let his, you know, drools. And Achish said to his servants, "Look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" First chapter 22, David therefore did what? He departed. They let him get away. You know, I said, he's not the king we thought he was. He's not this powerful warrior we thought he was. He's insane. And we can see that now. We don't need him. Just let him go. And they did. So did David's scheme work? But let me ask you this. How do you think David now looks in the eyes of the number one enemy of the people of Israel, Philistines? How does he look? He looks like a madman. He looks weak.
Disgraceful.
He looks disgraceful. He's shamed. And how does that make the Lord look? How does that make the God of Israel look now? I mean, David stood up in the name of the God of Israel and said, "You have shamed us, and he will win the victory." And now he's done something himself that shames himself and shames his God in the eyes of the enemies of the Lord. And so, you know, the scheme is not, you know, not exactly what we would want to see. Look at the next chapter. Yeah, I think we've got time to cover this. Verse 1, David therefore departed from there, and he escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. So as all his family hears that he's there, they know what the situation is, that he's fleeing from Saul. He's there, he's staying in a cave, and he's back in the land of Judah now. It says, and his family comes to stay with him. And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented, gathered to him. Here's the kind of army that David gathers to him. Who are the people? Well, everybody owes money. Let's phrase the first one. Everybody who's in distress. Everybody who's going through a lot of stress and pressure in their lives. Everybody who's in debt comes there. And everybody who's not happy, discontented, they all gather to David. Now, We might look at that and say that's because of the character change in David, but that could be that all these people look that way in the eyes of the world, but they're not necessarily that way in the eyes of God. That David has gathered to him a group of people that are going to stand with him. And he became captain over them. And there were about 400 men with him. So he's got a group now of about 400 men. And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother come here with you until I know what God will do for me." Stop there for just a second. Go to Moab. Now, why would he go to Moab? Think about this. Got any ties to Moab?
Saul's soldiers aren't there.
Saul's soldiers are not there. That's one thing. That's true. They're not going to be in Moab. Think back to the story of Ruth. Ruth and Boaz gave birth to what? Yeah. And you see the line there. There's a tie there between David's family and the Moabites because of Ruth. And that may have been one of the reasons that he goes there. And what he does is he brings his family there and he asks the king, he says, "Let my father and mother come here and stay with you." He wants his family to be safe. Because if Saul's going to come after him, they might also come after his family. You know, you come after the family and say, "David, if you don't come back, I'm going to kill your parents." Something like that, or kill your brothers, or whatever. So he wants to make sure his family is taken care of, his mother and father. But look at the last statement of verse 3. "Until I know what God will do for me." Is that a change? See, that's a change, I believe. I think you see a change. After these three schemes, and David, you know, and especially sinking as far down as he does to actually have to pretend madness in order to get away from the Philistines, I think he sees, "I haven't been trusting God." I think he sees something that has changed. In fact, he writes about it in one of the Psalms. Look with me. Keep your place right here and look with me in the 142nd Psalm. Psalm 142. Verse 1. He says, "I cry out to the Lord with my voice. With my voice to the Lord, I make my supplication." I can just picture him when he gets there to that cave and he recognizes and sees what he's done and how foolish he's behaved. And what kind of shame he's experienced for himself and God. I think he just cries out to God and says, "I need help. I need help." He says, "With my voice to the Lord, I make my supplication. I pour out my complaint before Him. I declare before Him my trouble." When should he have done this? Back in the very beginning, before he came up with all these schemes. But he does do it now. "When my spirit was overwhelmed within me." And I think that's how he was feeling. I think he was just feeling overwhelmed by everything that was going on. And I think that he sank back into the flesh. He just went back and began to walk in the flesh. He said, "When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then you knew my path. You knew my path. And in the way in which I walk, they have secretly set a snare for me. Look on my right hand and see, for there is no one who acknowledges me. Refuge has failed me. No one cares for my soul. So I cried out to you, O Lord. I said, 'You are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison, that I may praise your name. The righteous shall surround me, for you shall deal bountifully with me.'" I think he finally recognizes, I've got to trust the Lord through this. I've got to turn back to the Lord. And that's what I think he does, is he's sitting there in this cave, hiding from Saul, thinking back on what he's done, knowing he has to take care of his parents, and I think he realizes, "I've got to wait until I know what God will do for me." Because he realizes, if anything's going to happen to deliver me, it's going to be God doing it for me. Verse 4, "So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now the prophet Gad said to David, 'Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah.'" Who does a prophet speak for? Speaks for God. Speaks for God. And so that's what we've got here. We've got this prophet who's speaking for God. The prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay here. Depart and go to the land of Judah." He was in Moab. He says, "You need to get back to the land that God promised to your fathers." So David departed. He obeyed the voice of God's prophet. And he went into the forest of Herod. Now, let's turn back to Saul just quickly and look at this last part. Verse 6, "When Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered..." Now, Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand. He's always ready with that spear, even when he was sitting in his court. "And all of his servants are standing about him." So all his servants are standing around him. And he's come there to this place. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" Interesting statement. What's significant about this? The group of people that are around him, what are they? What do they call them?
Benjamites.
So all the people that are servants of Saul are from what tribe?
Benjamin.
Which tribe is he from? Sort of call this nepotism? Is that what we call this? He's got his own tribe. That's who surrounds him. That's who the servants are. He's the king of what nation? Israel. How many tribes? You'd think that there would be more than just the ones of Benjamin. And so he asked the people of Benjamin, "Do you think that the son of Jesse, who's from what tribe? Judah. He's from Judah. You think he's going to make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? You think you're going to be in positions of service and leadership under David? You think that's going to happen?" He says, "Listen, you need to be loyal to me because you're not going to be in any kind of positions." Now, David, when he gets in, doesn't do that at all. In fact, when you look at the split of the kingdom, into the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom, which two tribes go together in the southern kingdom?
Judah
and Benjamin. David doesn't hold it against them at all. You know, the fact that they were Saul's servants all this time. But you see the difference in attitude there of what Saul thinks and how he reasons and what David would actually do. He doesn't know and understand David at all. And he tells them, he says, "All of you have conspired against me." Saul has reached the point where he thinks everybody's against him. And I guess you can understand it a little bit. His son is David's best friend. His daughter is David's wife. You know, we look at that. So now he thinks all of his servants have conspired. "There's no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is not one of you who is sorry for me." Oh. "Or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day." Had that happened? Did Jonathan stir up David to lay in wait to kill his father? See, but that's what Saul thinks. He's paranoid. You can see he's just so tied up with all of this and his heart is so twisted that that's what he believes and thinks. And then answered Doeg, the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, and he gave him provisions, and he gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." See, this is the one that was held back and was there when David was with the priest. And, you know, he's an Edomite. He's not an Israelite. Where's Edom come from? The descendants of who?
Esau.
They're the descendants of Esau. Esau and Jacob, they get along? Not too good, no, not at all. And so he speaks up. He sees an opportunity here to get in good with King Saul. I think that's why he does this. He says, "I know some things. I'll tell you. Your servants won't tell you, but I'll tell you." Because he looks at an opportunity here to advance himself. He says, this Ahimelech, the priest, he inquired of the Lord for David. He gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Now, he may have actually done that. He probably did. David, I don't know that David asked him to do that, but he probably did that to see what he should do. So the king sent to call Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all of his father's house, the priests who were in Nob, and they all came to the king. And Saul said, "Hear now, son of Ahitub." And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me?" Again, even the priests of the Lord, he says, "You've conspired against me, all of you." He says, "You and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day." Now, did that happen? No, that wasn't what went on at all. David just wanted to do what? David doesn't want to rise up against Saul. He just wants to get away. He wants to get away. Live in peace is what he's wanting to right now. And Ahimelech, does he know anything about this? What's Ahimelech been told?
The king sent him.
He has no idea that David is fleeing from Saul and that all of this is going on. Saul's wanting to kill him. And he just, you know, he's at a loss for what's going on. But see, Saul's already got his mind made up. Not only had he done these things for David, given him food and a sword and inquired of the Lord, but he believes that David's going to rise up against Saul and the priests are helping him do that. So Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law? And who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house?" Is that what Saul wanted to hear? Who is as faithful as David? The last thing he wants to hear. Is that going to make him feel better? That's just going to make him feel worse. He says, "He's the king's son-in-law. He goes at your bidding," because that's what he'd been told. He goes at your bidding. He says, and he's honorable in your house. Did I then begin to inquire the Lord for, inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father. For your servant knew nothing of all of this. Little or much? I didn't know anything about this. I didn't know a little bit about it. I didn't know a lot about it. I didn't know anything about this. And the king said, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. The king said to the guards who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord. Now these priests in God's eyes are what? What's the word? They're holy. Set apart for God, for the service of God, to intervene between God and His people, to be mediators. And yet the king issues a command, you shall surely die. Turns to his servants and says, kill him. Kill him. You and your whole father's house. He says, kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand is also with David. And because they knew that when he fled and did not tell it to me. But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. They said, no. They understood at least enough about God's word to say, no, that's just wrong. We're not going to do it. Unfortunately, there's somebody there who doesn't care about the law of God, the law of the Lord, and whether the priests are holy or not. He looks at them as a stepping stone. That's all they are. And so the king said to Doeg, said, you turn and kill the priests. So Doeg the Edomite turned, and he struck the priests, and he killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. 85 priests died that day. And not only that, and also Nob, the city of the priests, where the priests were staying, that city, he struck with the edge of the sword. Now, does Saul tell him to do this? He didn't tell him to do this, but he goes into the city and he struck with the edge of the sword both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and donkeys and sheep with the edge of the sword. He wiped out that whole city. Wiped out that whole city because I'm sure Saul would assume that they're a part of it. That's where the priests were. They're a part of it. Now, one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub named Abiathar, he escaped and he fled. He went after David. He fled in the direction David went. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priest. And David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul. And David says this, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe. David acknowledges, this is all my fault. He says, I knew it. I knew that day when I saw him there that he would tell Saul. But what could he do about it? See, what could he do about it? He's caught up in all these lies and these schemes. He's on the run. There's nothing he could do. But because of his scheme, you see, if he had come in and told the truth to the priests, things might have been different, would they not? If he said, the king is after me, he's going to kill me. But he lied to the priest. And so because of that lie, all those men died. And he says, I've caused that. I'm the cause of that. He says, you stay with me. He tells the son of Ahimelech, you stay with me. He says, because the one who seeks to kill me seeks to kill you now. And he says, and you stay with me because you'll be safe with me. What does he now believe that he didn't believe before? That God will take care of him. God's going to take care of me. You stay with me, you'll be safe because God's going to take care of me. I think he believes that. And so you look at this situation and you think, by this time, David, I think, has turned his heart back to the Lord. By this time, David has learned to trust the Lord. He wasn't doing it before when he came up with all these schemes, I don't think. Now David is dependent upon the Lord and seeking the Lord's guidance. If you look at chapter 23, the first thing we see is that David inquired of the Lord, saying, what do you want me to do? And that's what he should have been doing all along. So you see the change in him. And yet, with all of that, we still see there are consequences to sin, do we not? David's changed, and God took him back. God was happy to have David turn his heart and life back to him, happy to have David trust the Lord again, happy to have David walking in the Spirit rather than walking in the flesh, and that was wonderful, but there's still consequences for sin, are there not? And in this particular, the consequences were very grave. From his earlier schemes and deceptions and lies, 85 priests died, and a whole city of men, women, children, and all their animals that they had died as well, all because of David's sin. And I think we have to understand that. Now, in our lives, we have to understand that when we sin against God, there are consequences. Don't think from that, I've sinned so terribly that I can't turn back to the Lord. Satan wants you to believe that. Satan would love to have you believe, I've done so many terrible things, God would never take me back. No, God wants you back. No matter what you've done, God wants you back. Walking with Him. serving Him, trusting Him, living for Him day by day. But that doesn't mean that you won't suffer the consequences of the sin that you committed. David did. And it didn't hurt him directly, as far as it did, you know, wasn't his family that died, his close friend died or something like that. But the people that died were important to this nation, important to him. And he had to live with the grief. He had to live with the guilt of it and go on with that. So there are certainly consequences to our sins. Next time we'll look at David's continued life as a fugitive. He remains a fugitive, you know, fleeing from Saul throughout the remainder of his life now until Saul's death. But we'll see that things are a little different now. Things are better. They're not going to be perfect in all things, but things are better now. And we'll see how things continue as we continue the study next time, the Lord willing. Let's have a word of prayer. Lewis, would you dismiss us in prayer?